Jackson Browne, you know, talks about his records as records, records of a moment in time for the artist or a moment in time for the world, you know, in some of his music. And, you know, I've read that you don't dwell too much on where you've been, but I'm wondering if, for the sake of this retrospective, if you could riff a little bit about each of your releases and just sort of kind of associations that come up when you think about that record and that time. And I know that can be complex and deep, but, you know, just give me a little thumbnail starting with okay. The first one, Steady On.
Steady On, well, you know, I made it with John Leventhal. We really kind of have a partnership, even though we haven't worked on every record together. I met him in 81 when I first moved to New York, and we began to write songs, most of which were pretty terrible. But eventually I kind of figured out what worked for me and what my voice was, I guess, you know, as a writer. And we just kind of hammered around New York for so long, and he'd had a couple of different bands, and I'd done country swing, and we had kind of a pop band for a while. And to finally get to this place, I mean, we were thrilled and we were terrified. And so Steady On was like manic excitement, you know? Everything, just every detail, we agonized. It was microscopic, you know? I don't think I could work that way again, but it was necessary and it was fun, you know? And John and I had a romantic relationship that wasn't going on anymore, so there was that kind of friction, and I think it all kind of made for what the record is, you know. You know, it turned out the way we wanted it to. I'm real happy with it. Yeah.
Well, is there a way to quantify or explain, articulate the heart space and head space that you were in, other than it was exciting and invigorating?
The material itself is kind of soul-searching, you know, coming of age, some lovesick stuff. It's a lot about our relationship, me just becoming a more whole person, I don't know. Felt like a somewhat rough and long journey from being a kid to actually this point in time in New York City and making my first record, and I was 30, maybe I was older. You know, I just wasn't one of those people that thought, that knew I would get there. You know, I just felt like if this is all I ever do, this is, you know, it's enough. I mean, I got this far. But my whole life kind of began to take shape in New York. Big problems were resolved in terms of drinking and just, that's the big problem that was resolved. And, you know, I made lifelong friends and connections, and, you know, my life kind of started to happen there. You know, really started to figure some things out and move forward rather than sort of move in circles. It kind of culminated for, you know, with that experience. Felt really lucky.
I've heard you tell this story, maybe you could tell it again, about what sounded like a breakthrough writing experience of Diamonds in the Rough, where I guess John was feeding you tracks to write to. Could you tell me that tale?
Yeah. Our way of writing, for the most part, was and continues to be that he just records tracks, you know, songs without melodies or words most of the time. And then he would give them to me, and I would write to them. And we started doing that, you know, in 81 or 82, and they were very pop-type tracks. And I was trying to write pop-type words, clever, catchy stuff. And it wasn't very good, you know? But I was writing something. I mean, so, you know, and him doing the tracks made it easier for me to write something because I was just too scared to write on my own. Although I had written I Don't Know Why when I first moved to New York, and I wrote it in my head, and I thought it was too simple a song to be a song, and I didn't play it for like forever, but you know, that's another story. And And we kind of played that out, you know, the pop band thing. And I just knew it wasn't me, you know, but I didn't know what else to do. I knew it's so simple, really. I finally kind of took stock and said, well, what do you do best and what do you love? And I was like, well, I play guitar and sing best. I mean, I can go out and entertain people that way, and I'm comfortable with it, and I do it well, and not everybody can do that. I mean, this is what I grew up loving, is people who played the guitar and sang and wrote their own songs. I just wasn't really writing songs that way, and I thought, well, duh, that's what it needs to be. So I had the track for Diamond in the Rough, and it was very kind of rhythm and blues pop. And, you know, I was a big lover of Joni Mitchell guitar playing, Richard Thompson guitar playing, tunings and kind of rhythmic strumming. And I just transposed the music that he had for Diamond in the Rough and made it kind of droney and folk blues. And then I just started singing nonsense over it to see what would happen. And I got as a little girl, I came down to the water, and I thought, oh, God, that's kind of twee, you know? I mean, is that really going to happen? I don't know. And I called him up and said, well, I got something here, and played it for him over the phone, and he said, that's good. Keep going with that. And I wrote Diamond in the Rough, and it, you know, pretty quickly kind of was there waiting. That's when I figured it out, you know? And it's changed since then. It's not, you know, but that was the template, and it served me well for at least the first couple of records to sort of base everything on my ability to play it and sing it alone.
And then the first album does win the Folk Grammy, which, you know, you arguably could say it wouldn't have if you hadn't found that space. I mean, if you kept going in a pop direction, it wouldn't have even qualified.
I don't
think
we would have made a record if we kept going in the pop direction.
And so I'll stay sort of chronologically to ask you to reflect, and I know you could say a little or a lot about so many songs, but maybe just pick a couple songs from that CD that still has some resonance for you.
A lot of them do. I do still perform a lot of them. I mean, it's. I think it holds true that that cliche that you have all this time to get to your first record, and the germs of the ideas of those songs went back a long way. I mean, from the time I kind of figured out how to do it to the time we made the record, wasn't so long, but I took ideas that I'd had years before and finished them out. Like Ricochet in Time was an old idea, and Stranded was kind of an old idea.
Hey, tell me a little bit more about those two, if you would, just because they're favorites of mine too.
Okay. I started Ricochet in Time when I moved to San Francisco, Berkeley actually, in 78, I think, which is which I call my lost weekend period. I had a really good time there, and I had a little place that I played regularly called Laval's Subterranean, and it was a little pizza place. But they had music, and I had a little kind of community there, and it was just one of those great places that are so important to musicians that they can, that, you know, I mean, I steadily went in there, and I never played anything I wrote, ever. I had a friend who wrote, and I would take his songs to try and be somewhat original. But and I had a day job working at a stained glass store. But I had this funny little attic room in a large old house where tons of people lived. A bunch of hippie deadheads lived there. And that's where I got a room. And the only room they had left was in the attic. It had a skylight window in it. I could open that skylight window and crawl out of it and sit on the roof and look across the bay to San Francisco. I would just basically sit there with a six-pack of Coors and mess around with the guitar because I was lonely and didn't really have anything else to do. And I never for a minute thought that anything I jot it down then would be anything I would play. I mean, I just can't stress enough how much I did not believe, you know, that was really possible or something I could do. And the whole first two verses of Ricochet and Time were written in that little attic room. And then I let it go. Never played it. There was no chorus. I mean, it wasn't a song to me. And I picked it up, you know, later and wrote the choruses and the last verse that I was befriended in this city. And that was obviously about New York to me. And the Ricochet in Time was, I don't know, I hadn't even begun to be a touring musician the way I have been the last 12 years. But I still felt like I was kind of bouncing around the planet, you know, with music. And that kind of defined me.
How about the guitar pluck signature of that piece?
Just seemed like a catchy little thing to do, you know.
Was that part of it early on? Or did
No, because it wasn't Ricochet in Time early on. That chorus came later, and I don't even remember where I got that idea, Ricochet in Time. I was interested at the time in interesting words. So I remember Shotgun Down the Avalanche. It was because I wanted to use avalanche, the word avalanche in a song. And I obviously thought it would be neat to use the word ricochet in a song. So, and then the little ping was just kind of a cute thing to do.
Well, I saw your show in Santa Fe and enjoyed it a lot. I have a couple questions about that.
Okay.
But one of them relates to Stranded because you were asking for requests. And
play it?
You didn't play it.
Ah.
And I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but I was getting a feel that it was too emotional to play, or it could also have been in a key you didn't want to sing, or I don't know what. But I'm curious. That song is really strong for me, and I think it was the song that I heard first from you that got my attention. And I don't know if that's true of other people. Certainly, a few people at Santa Fe felt that way. But is it a difficult song in any other way?
No, it's not. It's not difficult. Stranded isn't difficult to play. I just for some reason don't do it as much. I'm still capable. There are songs I'm not capable of playing in my catalog. I just couldn't play them anymore. That one I can, and I don't know why I didn't do it that day. It's nice that we're talking about these two because I wrote them alone. There are songs, you know, that I have just written by myself, and those are two of them. And Stranded, it's just another John Leventhal romance song. Kind of what the hell happened, you know, song. And the little guitar part that starts it and kind of goes throughout the song was, I thought it's, I remember just messing around with guitar parts and I kind of thought it sounded, I kind of based it on the Rolling Stones' Waiting on a Friend. And this was... and I don't really recall how I put it all together, but I know that I liked the imagery of being kind of trapped in another world in this, you know, romance that didn't work and you couldn't break out of it.
I mean, I've heard this in a few of your songs where there's seems to be like even an emotional break in the voice or something that really personalizes it. And the last time you sing Stranded, there's just that kind of catch and a little moment. Are those moments something that just happen on a take and you say, yeah, that feels right?
Yeah, yeah, it's a fragile feel in that song, you know. It's pretty raw in the sense of the fragility of it, you know. I mean, it's not like it's sung really raw or anything. It's kind of, it's delicate. So, yeah, it's nice I would let something like that go on that first record because, I mean, I slaved over those vocals in a way I would never do again. I mean, I wanted the breaths to be right, you know. So it's nice that I didn't it too perfect on that one because it shouldn't be perfect.
Do you remember, because I'm imagining it's about this time, do you remember the time in your life when you felt like you were being appreciated on stage for the whole creative package, you know, guitar, writing your own songs, singing voice?
Yeah, I remember it clearly, and this is probably a story I've told many times as well. There was a club in Cambridge, Massachusetts, called Passim. And it was like a coffee house. I mean, it's this tiny little place. It has a lot of history. It's still there. It was run by a guy named Bob Donlin, who used to run around with Jack Kerouac and stuff. And well, it was this place. It was there was an organization in New York City called Fast Folk. It was basically a songwriters group of a bunch of songwriters in the village that met regularly and started to make records every month, sort of as a way to put songs on records by people who didn't have any other way to record them or may never get heard, or it was just kind of a way to put songs out there. Compilations every month, and you could subscribe to it, and there was a concert once a year. It would happen at the Bottom Line. And then it happened, that concert happened in Boston, I don't know how many times, but I was really fortunate because I didn't really write, and I certainly didn't go to their meetings, but it all was centered around a little club in New York City on McDougal Street called the Speakeasy. And Jack Hardy was the leader of this thing, and Suzanne Vega was a prominent member that went, you know, to every songwriter get-together that they had and really honed her stuff there. And in fact, that group still continues, and one of the last records she did, Songs in Blue and Gray, she premiered, like, every song that she wrote at that songwriting group, so... But I never went to it because I wasn't a songwriter. But I wrote I Don't Know Why and began to play it at some point. And they were nice enough to kind of include me in their shows and on one of those records, you know. And one year we went to Boston with this Fast Folk, you know, review that we had. And somebody was there, probably Bob, who said, you know, you should come play at Club Passim. And I knew this was a listening room. It was like nothing that I'd really done before. I mean, I played tons of clubs in New York City, but not like this.
They're drinking, socializing clubs where you weren't being
heard. Yeah, well, and at the Speakeasy I was being heard, but it was still kind of like... Just show up and do a show, you know. And we had some cool combinations of people. I mean, John Gorka was around, and Lucy Kaplansky and I sang tons together. And we would go sing at this other place that I had a regular gig at called the Cottonwood Cafe on Bank Street. And actually, it was on Bleecker Street and Bank. But we didn't do a bunch of original stuff, you know. We just did stuff. We did original stuff from some people, but, you know, it still wasn't together yet for me. You know, I hadn't found it. And I got a gig opening for somebody, Greg Brown, at Passim in Boston, in Cambridge. And how many songs did I have? Like two, maybe? I had I Don't Know Why, and maybe I had Shotgun Down the Avalanche or Diamond in the Rough or both of those. I don't know. But I knew these were people that expected me to show up with my own stuff, you know. And they were listening crowd. I knew that too, you know. I mean, they came to hear the music. They weren't going to, you know, they're going to be having some cider and a piece of cake, you know. And they were, you know, they were diehards. They wanted to hear what you had to say. And so I was nervous as hell. And I kind of filled out my little set, you know, with stuff I hoped they wouldn't know by other people. And my own stuff. And that was... And then there was all this great college radio there, WUMB and WERS. that would play a cassette tape if you had one. And they did. They played cassette tapes. So I started building this following in Boston. Also, on Sundays at Pessim, you played the whole weekend for, like, you know, $100 or something. And every Sunday they would have an afternoon show that was broadcast on, I think it was on ERS. So I started to get a following in Boston and with, you know, like two songs. And so I was asked back. And I knew when I went back there, I better have something else, you know, or I'd look like a fool. So, and I'd play songs that I wrote for these people, and they got it, and they appreciated it. So to answer your question in a long-winded way, that was the first time I remember going like, okay, it's the whole package here. It's not just messing around, you know, and let's go have some beers afterwards. It's like, this is a gig.
Right. And then the aftermath for you emotionally, professionally, can you say how that took you from here to there?
Or? Yeah, it was vital because I'm the kind of person, you know, that has to work with deadlines anyway. I mean, I need some pressure. Otherwise, I'll just, you know, procrastinate. So it gave me confidence because they liked it. And I was getting a following. And the people, you know, there were people that wanted to come hear me. Not just because they also went in to have, you know, some fajitas. And I felt that I owed it to them to grow and have a larger catalog. It's what I wanted for myself, but this really gave me the impetus to do it. I needed that deadline. I needed that, you know, I wasn't the type of person who kind of woke up dying to get out the notebook, and I'm still not. You know, it's frightening for me. It always has been. I think it always will. I can get up in front of, you know, I could get up in front of 50,000 people and sing something. I don't care. That's fine. I can perform. But writing terrifies me. So it got me in the groove. You know?
This leads to kind of a boilerplate question about, you know, you talk about writing. Is there a preferred way to write? Do you have when you say take the notebook out, I mean, some writers have the notebook at hand all the time, and it's just like little scraps of language, and they occur to them. And
yeah.
So what's it like for you?
Well, that little scraps of language is pretty darn important. So much of what I just happened to decide to jot down when I'm in the car or something becomes something later. So the empty notebook is kind of more how it feels to me, you know. I mean, most of the work, a good deal of the work is done sort of, for me, in passing. Because if I think too hard about it or try too hard to be in it, you know, it suffers. So that kind of thing is very important. But, you know, I do know plenty of people who do enjoy getting, or not daunted, particularly by getting up and sitting down in front of a blank page and just seeing where it goes. And that's just not fun to me. I'll do it and have done it and will continue to do it because the reward is so fantastic. You know, to finish a song, to put something into it and finish it and play it for people is, there's nothing better.
So, like, if you get a request to do a soundtrack song or something, that's when you sit down with the assignment and...
I've done that, and it's worked out pretty poorly most of the time, except for one time I did a song for Tin Cup, and Ron Shelton had actually flown me to L.A. and showed me the scene that he wanted me to write it for. And... something just came to me right away, and I wrote this silly little song called Back to Salome, which he used in the end credits. He didn't use it at the place that he told me that he wanted it for, but that worked out. And I guess you can, was there a soundtrack to that? Yeah, there must have been a soundtrack. There was a lot of songs in that movie.
Well, it strikes me so many things can present themselves as metaphors for living and for survival. Does it feel like you always have your antenna up then looking for that? I mean, that's part of your role.
Yeah, I think it's part of my role, but as time's gone on, and especially since I became a parent, I kind of let the antenna down a little. It's starting to go back up. But for a while there, I wasn't tuning in, you know. So that's been interesting too, and I know we'll talk more about that. But you kind of want to keep your ears open for language. It's language, you know. I mean, John said the other day, I just saw these people and these twin homeless guys on the street, and they're twins, and they've been, wouldn't that be a great story? It's like a story doesn't really, I don't usually feel, I want to write about this story. Or it's a feeling, and it's coupled with the music and then language that's inspiring or interesting, or, you know, just a turn of word, you know, of phrase that feels good.
Okay, Fat City then takes you to a different place, and I don't want to make this too much like the album by album story of Sean, but I am interested in having you use them as posts, because that's how people listen to your stories. What's different about this heart and headspace that feeds this particular album?
It's hard to talk about them without feeling judgmental about them. This was a big departure, because I just felt, I actually started this record with John. And when I say started, I think we went in to the studio for maybe 1 or 2 days and tried to work. And I was really heartbroken about him. And I couldn't be steady on was one thing, because the material was done, and I don't know, it was like our destiny to do that record under, you know, under whatever circumstances. But I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't be in the same room with him. I was going to have to work with another producer, which is like, John was the guy I'd worked with. Just one record as a producer, but really, you know, for years and years. I mean, this is the person it's a big deal sort of for me to, you know, reveal your ideas to somebody. Even if you think they're done and they're good, you know, you got to play them for somebody. That's just always, you feel pretty naked, you know, and this was the person that, you know, was always first witness to any of these things I had. I'd never done that with anybody else. And I wound up working with Larry Klein, and I liked the work he'd done with Joni Mitchell.
And did you seek him out, or did he seek you out?
I sought him out.
Uh-huh.
Or did he seek me out, too? No, I think I sought him out. I can't remember, but we had a meeting in New York, and he was a really sweet guy. So I went out to L.A., and we started working, and it felt good, you know? It took a long time to make that record, and a lot of people prefer this record over some other ones, you know, like over Steady On. I mean, there are a lot of fans of this record, and I like some things on it very much. I mean, I think Polaroid's, you know, among the best songs that I've ever written. But there's some real self-conscious stuff to me on this record too, lyrically. So there's some songs on this record I just don't like to do. Larry was loads of fun. I loved every minute being with him. We're friends to this day. But it was a laborious record, you know. He was very meticulous. I think he's far less meticulous now when he produces. But then he was very meticulous. I was very meticulous. It just took a long, long time. And I guess, you know, the fact that we hadn't worked together before, we were a little bit, it took us time to get our footing with each other, you know, and get comfortable. But I had met someone else when I was on tour with Richard Thompson, Simon Tassano, who I married. And we weren't married at that time, but we were going out together. So there was a you know, there's some, like, Round of Blues is a song I wrote about that relationship. I really like that song. So there was, you know, I was kind of on the upswing as far as all that. It was a fresh kind of thing going on, you know, with a new relationship and working with Larry and being in California instead of New York. And also it was kind of my opportunity to do the California musician thing that I had, like, grown up with, you know, James Taylor's records, Joni Mitchell's records, Jackson Brown.
The Southern Cal sound
and the Southern Cal ensemble. I mean, you know, there were names that I'd seen again and again and again, and I got to use some of those people. Like, I looked up Valerie Carter, who I also thought was a great singer, and had her sing on it. We had Lee Sklar on bass. I had Jim Keltner on drums for some stuff. Did we have Crosby and Nash come in for something?
That's the quintessential.
Yeah, it is the quintessential. I might have had them come in on the next record, and then I'm trying to think who else we have. I know I'll leave somebody out and feel like a jerk, but
I really like Object of My Affection. Not just because I've been piecing together songs that use the Bo Diddley beat in some way, shape, or form, but what about that tune?
That started with this guitar riff that I think John would be co-credited on the song as a writer because this we totally ripped it off from Arthur McBride, which is a song that Paul Brady did. He didn't write it, but it was Paul Brady did a couple of records of sort of traditional Irish music with Andy Irvine. And Arthur McBride was one of these songs, and it was this it was a big deal for me, these Paul Brady, Andy Irvine songs, some of the Irish songs that they did. And Arthur McBride was really a big deal, and we just basically took John basically took the melody of Arthur McBride, this is the beginning melody, and put it in a guitar part. And we sped it up. And that's how that song started.
Okay, so this ensemble is very intriguing. The Subdudes.
Oh, yeah.
Joni Mitchell, percussion and claps. David Lindley on a bazooki.
Ah, there we go. Bing, 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 bing. There's the big California.
Yeah. Richie Hayward from Little Feet.
Right.
I mean, and I can hear in that, actually after that Bo Diddley break, there just seems to be this, like, laughter in the studio from, I'm wondering if
did we laugh?
Well, there's a good energy about it.
Yeah, I had heard the Subdudes, and I just loved them, and I loved that whole whacking on the tambourine that Steve Adie did, and I just wanted to get them, you know, I wanted to see what would happen, and we did two songs together, Object of My Affection and what was the other one, Tenderness on the Block, maybe? Yeah, Tenderness on the Block, Jackson Brown and Warren Zevon song. So yeah, that is a good we used David Lindley a lot on this record. He did the solo on Polaroids and bunch of stuff. Joni, I think she clapped her hands for something. You know, it was just such a big deal for me to, like, be able to credit her on one of my records. And then, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and then I'm looking at Tennessee as another kind of big ensemble that has Bela Fleck and Bill Payne and I've always
Richard
liked
Thompson's
that
on Tennessee.
And I have to say, I did like your Bora Bora take on Tennessee, too.
Wacky drummers?
Yeah.
Yeah, that worked out well.
That was pretty clever.
Yeah, Tennessee's a song I still play.
Why do you like it?
No, I mean, like, Object of My Affection, I don't play. The Sylvia Plath line, I just want to shoot myself. Well, that's a horrible choice of words I'm talking about. But, you know, it's just that, it's like, it's such a, you know, I just kind of over-cuted myself on that. So I try to be literary and kind of whimsical and just, you know, I want to slap myself. Although I like the music a lot. Tennessee, I still like it. I just think it's good. I just think it tells the story that I wanted to tell about just a guy that I knew in Tennessee, who I really liked, and it kind of all went to hell in a handbasket pretty quickly, and And there was really nothing to tell. But there's, when things like that happen, there's so much feeling that you have for some reason. You know, it's the time, it's the place, it's the person. It's just, it's a lot of things. And I just feel like I succeeded in using the place and kind of just taking a little snapshot, the whole, the you know, the back roads thing, and kind of, it kind of felt nasty and dark. And that was a John Leventhal thing, that ding, 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 ding. And then I think I wrote the chorus, and it was, I just liked the way the whole thing turned out. I like the feeling of it. I like the words. You know, I like the spirit of it.